Chapter 2. I was not left very long at the mercy of the tousle-headed poet, because another passenger interrupted our conversation. But before that happened, I had learned a good deal about him. He appeared to be a singularly ill-used man. His parents had never appreciated him, and none of the five schools at which he had been educated seemed to have made any provision for a talent and temperament such as his. To make matters worse, he had been exactly the sort of boy in whose case the examination system works out with the maximum unfairness and absurdity. It was not until he reached the university that he began to recognize that all these injustices did not come by chance, but were the inevitable results of our economic system. Capitalism did not merely enslave the workers, it also vitiated taste and vulgarized intellect, hence our educational system, and hence the lack of recognition for new genius. This discovery had made him a communist. But when the war came along and he saw Russia in alliance with the capitalist governments, he had found himself once more isolated and had to become a conscientious objector. The indignities he suffered at this stage of his career had, he confessed, embittered him. He decided he could serve the cause best by going to America, but then America came into the war too. It was at this point that he suddenly saw Sweden as the home of a really new and radical art, but the various oppressors had given him no facilities for going to Sweden. There were money troubles. His father, who had never progressed beyond the most atrocious mental complacency and smugness of the Victorian epoch, was giving him a ludicrously inadequate allowance, and he had been very badly treated by a girl, too. He had thought her a really civilized and adult personality, and then she had unexpectedly revealed that she was a mass of bourgeois prejudices and monogamic instincts. Jealousy, possessiveness, was a quality he particularly disliked. She had even shown herself at the end to be mean about money. That was the last straw. He had jumped under a train. I gave a start, but he took no notice. Even then, he continued, ill luck had continued to dog him. He'd been sent to the grey town. But of course it was a mistake. I would find, he assured me, that all the other passengers would be with me on the return journey, but he would not. He was going to stay there. He felt quite certain that he was going where, at last, his finely critical spirit would no longer be outraged by an uncongenial environment, where he would find recognition and appreciation. Meanwhile, since I hadn't got my glasses, he would read me the passage about which Cyril Blello had been so insensitive. It was just then that we were interrupted. One of the quarrels which were perpetually simmering in the bus had boiled over, and for a moment there was a stampede. Knives were drawn, pistols were fired, but it all seemed strangely innocuous, and when it was over I found myself unharmed, though in a different seat and with a new companion. He was an intelligent-looking man with a rather bulbous nose and a bowler hat. I looked out of the windows. We were now so high that all below us had become featureless, but fields, rivers, or mountains I did not see, and I got the impression that the grey town still filled the whole field of vision. "It seems the deuce of a town," I volunteered, "and that's what I can't understand. The parts of it that I saw were so empty. Was there once a much larger population?" "Not at all," said my neighbour. "The trouble is that they're so quarrelsome. As soon as anyone arrives, he settles in some street. Before he's been there 24 hours, he quarrels with his neighbour. Before the week is over, he's quarrelled so badly that he decides to move. Very like he finds the next street empty because all the people there have quarrelled with their neighbours and moved. So he settles in. If by any chance the street is full, he goes further. But even if he stays, it makes no odds. He's sure to have another quarrel pretty soon, and then he'll move on again. Finally, he'll move right out to the edge of the town and build a new house. You see, it's easy here. You've only got to think a house, and there it is. That's how the town keeps on growing.
Leaving more and more empty streets?
That's right. And time's sort of odd here. That place where we caught the bus is thousands of miles from the civic centre, where all the newcomers arrive from Earth. All the people you've met were living near the bus stop, but they'd taken centuries of our time to get there by gradual removals.
And what about the earlier arrivals?
I mean, there must be people who came from Earth to your town even longer ago.
That's right, there are.
They've been moving on and on, getting further apart.
They're so far off by now that they could never think of coming to the bus stop at all. Astronomical distances. There's a bit of rising ground near where I live, and a chap has a telescope. You can see the lights of the inhabited houses, where those old ones live, millions of miles away. Millions of miles from us and from one another. Every now and then they move further still. That's one of the disappointments. I thought you'd meet interesting historical characters, but you don't. They're too far away. Would they get to the bus stop in time if they ever set out? Well, theoretically. But it'd be a distance of light years, and they wouldn't want to by now. Not those old chaps like Tamburlaine and Genghis Khan, or Julius Caesar, or Henry V. Wouldn't want to. That's right. The nearest of those old ones is Napoleon. We know that because two chaps made the journey to see him. They'd started long before I came, of course, but I was there when they came back. About 15,000 years of our time it took them. We've picked out the house by now. Just a little pinprick of light and nothing else near it for millions of miles. But they got there? That's right. He'd built himself a huge house, all in the Empire style. Rows of windows flaming with light, though it only shows as a pinprick from where I live. Did they see Napoleon? That's right. They went up and looked through one of the windows. Napoleon was there, all right. What was he doing? Walking up and down all the time. Left, right, never stopping for a moment. The two chaps watched him for about a year, and he never rested. And muttering to himself all the time, it was Soult's fault, it was Ney's fault, it was Josephine's fault, it was the fault of the Russians, it was the fault of the English. Like that all the time. Never stopped for a moment. A little fat man, and he looked kind of tired, but he didn't seem able to stop it. From the vibrations I gathered that the bus was still moving, but there was now nothing to be seen from the windows which confirmed this. Nothing but grey void above and below. "Then the town will go on spreading indefinitely," I said. "That's right," said the intelligent man. "Unless someone can do something about it." "How do you mean?" "Well, as a matter of fact, between you and me and the wall, that's my job at the moment. What's the trouble about this place? Not that people are quarrelsome, that's only human nature, and was always the same even on Earth. The trouble is, they have no needs. You get everything you want." Not very good quality, of course, by just imagining it. That's why it never costs any trouble to move to another street or build another house. In other words, there's no proper economic basis for any community life. If they needed real shops, chaps would have to stay near where the real shops were. If they needed real houses, they'd have to stay near where builders were. It's scarcity that enables a society to exist. Well, that's where I come in. I'm not going this trip for my health. As far as that goes, I don't think it would suit me up there. But if I can come back with some real commodities, anything at all that you could really bite or drink or sit on, why, at once you'd get a demand down in our town. I'd start a little business. I'd have something to sell. You'd soon get people coming to live near. Centralisation. Two fully inhabited streets would accommodate the people that are now spread over a million square miles of empty streets. I'd make a nice little profit and be a public benefactor as well.
You mean, if they had to live together, they'd gradually learn to quarrel less?
Well, I don't know about that. I dare say they could be kept a bit quieter. You'd have a chance to build up a police force, knock some kind of discipline into them. Anyway, here he dropped his voice. It'd be better, you know. Everyone admits that. Safety in numbers.
Safety from what? I began, but my companion nudged me to be silent. I changed my question. "But look here," said I, "if they can get everything just by imagining it, why would they want any real things, as you call them? Eh? Oh, well, they'd like houses that really kept out the rain."
"Their present houses don't?"
"Well, of course not. How could they?"
"What the devil is the use of building them, then?"
The intelligent man put his head closer to mine.
"Safety again," he muttered. "At least the feeling of safety. It's all right now. But later on, you understand."
"What?" said I, almost involuntarily sinking my own voice to a whisper. He articulated noiselessly, as if expecting that I understood lip-reading. I put my ear close to his mouth. "Speak up," I said.
"It will be dark presently," he mouthed.
"You mean the evening is really going to turn into a night in the end?"
He nodded. "What's that got to do with it?" said I.
"Well, no one wants to be out of doors when that happens."
"Why?" His reply was so furtive that I had to ask him several times to repeat it. When he had done so, being a little annoyed, as one so often is with whisperers, I replied without remembering to lower my voice. "Who are they?" I asked. "And what are you afraid they'll do to you? And why should they come out when it's dark? And what protection could an imaginary house give if there was any danger?"
"Here!" shouted the big man. "Who's talking all that stuff? You stop your whispering, you two, if you don't want a hiding seat. Spreading rumours, that's what I call it. You shut your face, Ikey, see?"
"Quite right. Scandalous. Ought to be prosecuted. How did they get into the bus?"
growled the passengers. A fat, clean-shaven man who sat on the seat in front of me leaned back and addressed me in a cultured voice. "Excuse me," he said, "but I couldn't help overhearing parts of your conversation. It is astonishing how these primitive superstitions linger on. I beg your pardon? Oh, God bless my soul, that's all it is. There is not a shred of evidence that this twilight is ever going to turn into a night. There has been a revolution of opinion on that in educated circles. I am surprised that you haven't heard of it. All the nightmare fantasies of our ancestors are being swept away. What we now see in this subdued and delicate half-light is the promise of the dawn, the slow turning of a whole nation towards the light, slow and imperceptible, of course, and not through eastern windows only. When daylight comes, comes in the light. And that passion for real commodities, which our friend speaks of, is only materialism, you know. It's retrogressive, earthbound, a hankering for matter. But we look on this spiritual city, for with all its faults it is spiritual, as a nursery in which the creative functions of man, now freed from the clogs of matter, begin to try their wings. A sublime thought." Hours later there came a change. It began to grow light in the bus. The greyness outside the windows turned from mud colour to mother of pearl, then to faintest blue, then to a bright blueness that stung the eyes. We seemed to be floating in a pure vacancy. There were no lands, no sun, no stars in sight, only the radiant abyss. I let down the window beside me. Delicious freshness came in for a second, and then, "What the hell are you doing?" shouted the intelligent man, leaning roughly across me and pulling the window sharply up. "Want us all to catch our death of cold?"
"Hit him a biff," said the big man.
I glanced round the bus. Though the windows were closed and soon muffed, the bus was full of light. It was cruel light. I shrank from the faces and forms by which I was surrounded. They were all fixed faces, full not of possibilities, but of impossibilities. Some gaunt, some bloated, some glaring with idiotic ferocity, some drowned beyond recovery in dreams, but all, in one way or another, distorted and faded. One had a feeling that they might fall to pieces at any moment if the light grew much stronger. Then there was a mirror on the end wall of the bus. I caught sight of my own. And still the light grew.